Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight, and it's a real pleasure to talk to her again, is Karima Moyer Noki. She's a culinary historian specializing in Italian food. She teaches at the University of Siena, and we're continuing our conversation about her book, which really took me by surprise, The Epic History of Macaroni and Cheese from Ancient Rome to Modern America. Now, the reason I say it took me by surprise is I thought it, you know, it'd be sort of an interesting thing. I didn't realize it would be dramatically historical, and especially in the section we're going to talk about. The last part of your book, it's almost like it's a separate book, is your chapters on macaroni cheese in America. And I had no clue of the history that you dug up on this, and it's amazingly revealing. I think it's the kind of history that most people should read about, because it has so many sort of side stories. How early did macaroni and cheese come to America? Maybe I'll frame it this way. When did it first appear in American cookbooks?
Those are two completely different questions. So,
okay, well then answer them any way you want.
So we have inklings of pasta coming over to the colonies already in the early 18th century.
Okay.
So mostly in the form of vermicelli through cookbooks, even though macaroni was something that was known. Now, the way this is coming over culturally is because the colonists had this umbilical cord that they kowtowed to the dictates of France and England as far as what they needed to do at the table. So what they were supposed to prepare, how to prepare it, what to eat, and how to act while they were eating it. So, the social death that would have occurred if you didn't know all of those rules was really very important to them. They were clinging to a culture that they were very far away from. So, and part of that culture in England and France at the time was this dish, macaroni and cheese. But what really brought it to the fore in the middle of the 18th century is a thing called macaroni fashion.
Hmm.
Now, this resulted from young men going to the continent to finish their sort of adulthood and going to Rome through France, obviously, because they weren't flying there, and picking up certain airs and ways and food habits and going back, at which time a veritable subculture developed of dress and hair and obnoxious behavior, music, theater, poems, all around this this figure. Now, I like to liken it to a hippie. If I say hippie, everyone knows what I'm talking about, even though we're 60 years on from it. And it conjures up an immediate culture of a person type.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing could be said if you talked about a macaroni. And this figure was also important in the colonies. You see already in 1769, I found advertisements for macaroni apparel.
Huh.
And in that same year, we get a recipe that was in a book that circulated in the colonies in 1769 for macaroni and cheese. But it's riding the wave of something that was already culturally legible, because when you've got this fashion that made it very visible, you enhance the desirability of it, and of course, people always want to make a buck, and there you have the availability of it. So we're already seeing shipments of pasta, of macaroni specifically, coming into the colonies in 1772. And it's going to take hold because the food has meaning.
Right.
And meaning is always really important.
Yeah, I've got to stop you, Karima. So Yankee Doodle Dandy stuck a feather in his hat and called it macaroni. Is that what that is referring to?
That is exactly what that's referring to. So what that's doing is it's taking, it was a British ditty that came out in around the mid-1750s, and it was making fun of Americans who thought that, you know, these American yokels who thought that they could just put a feather in their cap and that they would be following the fashion of macaroni because they were those poor sods. They were so backwards. Stuck a feather in his hat, macaroni. So the Americans, of course, took this and they just took that knife by the handle and made it into an anthem during the American Revolutionary War.
What's amazing about your book is, like I have mentioned and alluded to before, it's several different histories. It's a history of cookbooks, too. And the Practical American Cookbook, I think it was in 1855, it was an attempt to match the American experience, at least as they thought of it, to have a cookbook that matched that. And probity, as you write in your book, was the American way. That people were expected to be frugal, and that was the cornerstone of the sort of Republican edifice of America. And this is all from your book, fast and simple foods. One of the interesting foods that they used is they substituted for Parmesan pineapple cheese. What is that?
So pineapple cheese
has no pineapple in it.
There's no pineapple in it. So you're talking about the period when Americans are starting to declare their independence from this British and French thing that I was talking about before.
Yeah.
But pulling it in just the same, just relabeling it American, and maybe making it simpler and faster, and using more local ingredients. One of the local ingredients, so we have a series of books that are coming, the National Cookbook and the American Ladies Cookbook and things like that, that are specifically pointing out Americans and in the spirit of Walt Whitman and American exceptionalism. So pineapple cheese, just to get to your point, was a creamy sort of cheddar. Okay. It was done with a cheddaring process it was done in two ways. Either you put it into a mold that was shaped like a pineapple, had those sort of armor-like things on the outside, or it was put into the Italian word's coming there, arete, like a fisherman's net. It was put into a netting that would then result, when it was hung up, it would result in this pineapple-shaped sort of thing.
Okay.
And that was a very popular cheese for a long time. It was it had been made since the American Revolutionary times, but really became popular and then was patented in the...
It was Goshen, Connecticut. It was someplace in Goshen.
Yes, in Connecticut. Kraft ended up buying it out, as he did with so many other situations. Wherever he saw anyone who was making money on cheese, he was going to buy them out. So he produced it until 1931. But that was a popular cheese that went into an American-style macaroni.
There's a theme, a story that runs through this part of your book, too, which is about the Black experience from this before the Civil War right up into today. And how macaroni and cheese figures into that. And during and before the Civil War, of course, during the slavery period, Black Americans became very good at learning recipes and making them their own. And that's going to figure later on in life. But that was an amazing history to me, to read all about how Black Americans during slavery and in Reconstruction really figured into the food industry, getting their own restaurants, getting their own places to make food, writing recipe books. It's an interesting story that I never imagined before, but it explains one of the notions why historically macaroni and cheese is important to Black culture in America.
Yes, this is while the whole history is going on, including what I was talking about with the English and French,
yeah.
And then you have centuries of African American women at the helm of kitchens in the South, but also in the North, who are cooking this dish, because when we're talking about the antebellum years, African American cooks needed to have a repertoire of English and French cookery, and that was expected of them. And they were the ones who built the legacy of hospitality in the South.
Yeah.
And so after the Civil War, what happens of these women who had never been recognized in the Southern cookbooks, there was a series of Southern cookbooks, suddenly when they were no longer being subjugated, this figure of Mammy was then used by white authors to create this image of the Old South and Old South cookery. Meanwhile, African American women had moved on. There was the period of the Great Migration, two waves of the Great Migration, where there is a development of the diaspora of African Americans throughout the United States. And they're bringing with them the dishes that they had known as everyday foods. But once you get out of your immediate environment, and you begin to see or have a different kind of awareness of the foods that you had thought were everyday, that suddenly become very important in creating an identity. They create community. They're ways for people to be together. And this once aspirational dish, macaroni, for various reasons, increases in technology, things that were making it more accessible to everyday Americans. But the aspirational quality of this dish remained. So that was one of the dishes that would become one of the representative dishes of what would end up being soul food. These dishes that represented a period of resistance and resilience, and even though when you're putting it together with, let's say, hog maw, catfish, greens, cornbread, macaroni seems to be the outlier.
Right.
But this dish had always been in the hands of African American women, and so it takes its rightful place in the soul food canon when that comes out, particularly during the Civil Rights movement.
There are women that you write about, Eliza Seymour Lee, who, as you write, exemplifies the culinary networks of antebellum South. She purchased the Jones Inn in Charleston, South Carolina, and turned it into a high-end eating place.
She's in Charleston, and she her inn, which had a restaurant, she was the daughter of a former slave who had been freed, and was herself, as her mother had been, was also a slave owner. So she trained African Americans to a very high level of cooking, and her inn and her restaurant were known throughout the Charleston area as setting the bar for high quality food. So, and that is a legacy that would also carry through later in the 19th century, in the later 19th century, with African American caterers in particular, who were very well known, who were carrying on these traditions of macaroni and cheese, keeping it an aspirational dish. Now, this, when I keep talking about aspiration, this is what gives meaning to food and what people aspire to eat. So when you're seeing it in a restaurant, or with catering, the high-end elite levels of food, it's going to keep it an aspirational dish, and desirable as well.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Karima Moyer Noki. She's a culinary historian specializing in Italian food. She teaches at the University of Siena. And we're continuing our conversation about her book, The Epic History of Macaroni and Cheese from Ancient Rome to Modern America. You paint a really interesting picture in the book. The Civil War ends, and Southern white women, who had not really been doing any cooking, finally faced the fact that they had to learn what they were going to be doing in the kitchen. And all that knowledge went north with the black Americans, the former slaves, and they had to learn pretty fast about what they were going to do in the kitchen.
Yes, and that came out a lot through, as I was talking about, there was a new era of very self-aware Southern food, trying to capture what
right,
they felt was disappearing. So because the staff of cooks was no longer at their beck and call. And that seemed to, the subjugation of African-American women seemed to be what the good old South was. And saving that in a new era of white women writing cookbooks was in some way preserving that. And then you have, but bringing that African-American female cook to the fore as a representative of what quality food is.
Right.
So then we have a woman, Emma Hayes. So Emma Hayes then, she wrote the Kentucky Cookbook and calls it, she says on her title page, by a colored cook. Or by a colored woman,
right.
She says. Because what she's doing is she's saying, she's taking that secondhand voice and putting it into her firsthand voice and her firsthand experience and saying, well, I am actually an African-American woman doing who has lots of experience doing my own cooking, and this is my book.
Yeah.
And that sets up for then opens the floodgates for African American women writing their own cookbooks.
Well, I want to skip around a bit because we're going to run out of time. There's so much to talk about in this section. There's a whole xenophobic thing, anti-Italian production of pasta. That just, I had, again, no clue that went on. But what a bizarre part of the history of America that is. That there were all these stories about the pasta that was made in Italy. They hung out the pasta. It was covered with flies. People with dirty hands are touching it. And so we need to make the pasta in America. And this is where Kraft comes in, too, again. Talk about that. I mean, that was wild.
So the at the end of the 19th century, you have Juliet Corson, who's really campaigning to make macaroni and cheese, to bring that to the attention
pasta
of
for the
reformers.
People. Yep.
Because that's right, because it was a very important food reform period, and at the same time, she was talking about boiling it so much that it would quadruple in weight. So you're talking about some very soggy...
Not al dente.
Some very soggy macaroni that's going to end up filling up the stomachs of
There was a huge economic downturn in America at that time.
Right, because it was that whole century was plagued by what was called what were called panics.
Mm.
So an economic panic, and so the economic panic, that's touching on the economic panic of 1873,
mm.
And 1877 was the Great Railroad Strike, and she was very strong in that. But by 1888, in her 10 years later, in another cookbook, she's already saying that macaroni had become a favorite American food.
Yeah.
So already in 1888, during the 80s, you have a big exodus of Italians who are escaping not only poverty, but the strife of cholera. And so what they end up doing, many of them, is macaroni factories in the U.S. And but their product, they're having difficulty with the imported macaroni because Italians are using semolina wheat. And that's making those beautiful golden tubes. Americans are making these very chalky things with standard soft wheat. And so they really can't compete. The other reason that they can't compete is because in the U.S., they have to pay their workers more in order to give them a living wage. So instead of getting the light bulb about planting, durum wheat in the U.S., which they didn't have. There was no durum wheat in the U.S. They decided they would do what Americans do and put tariffs on the imported macaroni. And so that was going to resolve the problem. And they put a tariff on, and they put another tariff on. And then the light bulb went off, finally, at the end of the century. And they thought, well, we're going to try planting durum wheat. So, but in the meantime, the macaroni manufacturers in the U.S. did a smear campaign on the Italians about how dirty their pasta was and how dirty the conditions were. And then the cholera thing was really great because then they were not only dirty, they were diseased. And the Italian-Americans were very much part of that smear campaign because they were the ones who were setting up the macaroni manufacturing in the U.S.
And it's amazing because Kraft, the person, really becomes sort of a central I don't know what you would call a figure in this, of really sort of creating the idea. I think the phrase he uses, the first hands to touch it are yours, when he's talking about his packaged macaroni. So there was this thing is that we're doing a very sanitary project. It may taste like crap, but that's okay because your hands will be the first people to touch it. I just find that whole thing. How did you find the character of Kraft?
So Kraft is very well named. He's a crafty guy.
No kidding.
And always seems to be in the right place at the right time. He is Canadian originally, and then moved to the U.S. set up a cheesemongering business where he was kind of the go-between from the wholesalers to the retailers, and that's how he got into the business. But it was during a time when you're talking about the first hands to touch it are yours.
Yeah.
When people were very worried about food. Food adulteration was just rampant.
The same thing was happening with bread at the time, I think, too.
Yeah, yeah, and
Wonder Bread came out at
all kinds of things in bread to make it look whiter,
right?
So chalk and things like that. But so the Pure Food Act came out. I believe that was 1906. But people were very concerned about food purity, and so when we think about artisan food and craft whatevers, not meaning craft, the guy craft, but artisanal artisan foods, things that are made in so-called time-honored way, people wanted industrialized food.
Yeah.
Industry meant clean. And Kraft advertised, he was originally a cheesemonger, as I said, advertised his cheese in an image where you've got women in white aprons. Mm-hmm. It looks like a hospital almost. And then the slogan was, the first hands to touch it are yours. Which mouth-watering didn't even figure into the whole thing about how tasty it was. It's just that it was clean. And so clean was very important.
Also, it was fast and cheap.
And it was fast and cheap. It was. He then came out with his patented his processed cheese. His processed.
Well, he bought the rights to. First of all, there's so many interesting facts that I got to learn in your book. He bought the rights to Velveeta.
He bought the rights to Velveeta, and that was late because he needed to buy everyone out. So, and because he had the patent on processed cheese and tried to sue people where he could, saying that they had it was for patent infringement. So it was, but that was what people were looking for. In fact, processed cheese became America's a most loved cheese. When there, it was their go-to cheese because it was safe. It was shelf stable at a time when not everyone had a refrigerator, and it was reliable. You knew it was going to be exactly the same every single time, and last for a really long time. Also melt really well on macaroni.
So do candles. That one was especially important in the South because there were not a lot of cheesemongers, as you write about, in the South. So it's very appealing to Southern culture to have this kind of cheese and macaroni prepackaged. And just, we're going to have to hang up soon, but I love the reading that during Prohibition, some beer makers, like Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, turned to cheese making during Prohibition.
Yeah, so Pabst and Kraft in particular had this sort of this battle going on. And this was before Kraft had come out in 1937 with their packaged Kraft dinner. Both of them had a very creamy cheese, the Velveeta-ish cheese that melted very well and Pabst had this thing that had this awful name, Pabst Et. Now you have to really put your lips together, Pabst Et, to just get it out of your mouth.
We're completely out of time, Karima.
Okay.
And I'm going to have to cut. Well, this is a good indication of how entertaining your book is. My returning guest tonight is Karima Moyer Noki. She is a culinary historian specializing in Italian food. She teaches at the University of Siena, and we've been talking about her book. And trust me, we just glanced over a few parts of it. The Epic History of Macaroni and Cheese from Ancient Rome to Modern America. It is such an entertaining and fascinating book, and it makes me want to read more and more culinary histories. Karima, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's really, really been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.